Hello, I'm Michael Hainsworth. Now that the dust has settled on Ontario Budget 2024, what have we learned? The economic engine of Canada, responsible for 38 cents on every dollar's worth of GDP, is projecting a $9.8 billion 2024 deficit, almost twice what it predicted in the fall. Yet, it's still forecasting a balanced budget in the next election year of 2026. Meet Bill Robson, CEO of the CD Howe Institute. He published the day after Ontario Budget 2024 that the document consists mostly of general statements on improvements needed and broad comments on what's being planned, leaving many questions unanswered. He joins us now. Bill, good to see you again.
Michael, thanks for having me, and looking forward to discussing what we can see. It didn't raise a lot of dust, actually, but now that the dust has settled and what we can see.
So what is the biggest unanswered question to you?
I think that the big picture concern that I have is we kind of live in populist times. The bottom line is clearly not a concern. Once upon a time, we might have, in broad terms, expected conservative governments to be a bit more fiscally conservative and mindful of the bottom line. And I think that the mood of the population maybe generally right now is a little bit, let's kind of live and spend for today. And the imperative that people used to feel to steward public finances a little bit more responsibly and sustainably has turned into a bit of a partisan problem, in the sense that, why tidy the books up if your successor is just going to make a mess of it and leave you with a mess to tidy up? So that's kind of a big picture concern that I have. You mentioned the deficit. The other thing that is very conspicuous in the Ontario budget, when you read past the kind of main text and look at the financing requirement and so on, is that they are continuing to spend a lot of money, borrow a lot of money for capital projects. And that doesn't create a deficit, because capital, you write it off over time as it delivers its services. And that's all very appropriate. And I think a lot of the infrastructure that's getting built is going to be helpful. Will benefit the economy, raise people's living standards, but there's just so much of it. And you do have to worry, with interest rates having gone higher and the overt deficit also heading in the wrong direction, that there's just not quite the political imperative to steward the bottom line. So that's a bit of a concern.
You mentioned the infrastructure spending. You know, the perfect example, I suppose, York University is going to be getting its own medical school that will be focused on general practitioners. Building that facility is going to be a capital cost, but we've had these discussions in the past. It's not just about capital costs, it's about ongoing additional operating costs that come with throwing big money at big projects.
Well, that's true. And that's money that is going to have to be spent in the future. So the virtue of using this kind of approach for capital spending, as opposed to doing what cities do, where they just treat it all like a cash outlay, that is that you do match costs and benefits better over time for the capital itself. And at least you've got some kind of an eye on the ongoing expenses and that. But you're right. There are all the operating costs. And if we go to a couple of other things that are in the budget that are a bit more of a concern, I find this idea that we're just going to ban road tolls pretty silly, because sometimes tolls on roads and bridges make perfect sense. It gets the user to pay. If you're going to charge people for using public transit, but not charge them for using roads, well, guess what people are going to do? Also, we see the continuing freeze, just as it's relevant to York University, I mentioned, that's the continuing the freeze in post-secondary education. And that is clearly not a helpful thing when it comes to paying the ongoing costs of operating the system. And it's been a few years now that freeze has been in place. And the post-secondary sector is clearly feeling a pinch. So that's one area where you kind of feel like they are kicking a can down the road. On that theme, the gas and fuel tax rebates continuing, and this massive electricity subsidy they pay every year. It's now in excess of $7 billion so that people aren't facing the full cost of Ontario's electricity system. That is a lot of money to be spending. So they're a bit trapped in this mode of just like not really wanting to grasp the nettle on a few of these items that really as I say, kicking the can down the road. Some future government is going to have to deal with this, and it's not getting any easier as time goes by.
Well, how far down the road can we kick that can? The plan is to balance the budget by 2026. You think they can do it, but how?
Well, I do think they can do it. I want to pay a compliment because we've started off on a couple of criticisms, and they're well-deserved. I do want to make a couple of observations, though, that I think matter more than they're often given credit for, and that is Ontario presented its budget on time. Now, not by much. The fiscal year ends March 31st, and they didn't beat that deadline by more than a few days. However, the feds haven't done that. They're not delivering their budget until April, so the fiscal year is well underway by the time they deliver. And the city of Toronto was ridiculously late. They operate on a calendar year and didn't get anything settled for months. But the other thing that I want to mention kind of in a similar vein is that when you look at the Ontario budget, you don't need to be an expert to start flipping pages at the beginning and quickly come across the numbers that really matter. And again, I want to pay that compliment and also in contrast to the federal government, which is a complete mess. Their key numbers don't appear until hundreds of pages into the document in an annex where a person might think, well, how could anything important be buried this deep? And the city of Toronto, where you can't even figure out what the numbers are, there's absolutely nothing to help you sort out what's going to happen over the course of the year and how big their surplus will be. And they will run a surplus, notwithstanding all the rhetoric. So Ontario is different. Ontario, you can look at the numbers and they present everything line by line the same way that they do when they report at the end of the year. So when it comes to looking at the individual line items and saying, okay, now how's all this going to work? It's all laid out. And although you can ask questions, for example, what are they saying for corporate income taxes? Are they being too pessimistic? Do they have the right amount built in for healthcare spending? There's a lot to examine in the detail, but they do provide the detail. And one of the things that I like about the Ontario budget is that when it's laid out that way, you can see some of the spending that is probably going to be one-time spending. They've also got an explicit contingency reserve and a prudence cushion on the bottom line. There's a bit of controversy about that, but I like the transparent versions of those as opposed to governments in the past that kind of hid them away or didn't provide them at all. So my big picture answer to the question there is, yeah, they can do it. There's nothing incredible in any of those individual forecasts. If the economy breaks a little bit more their way, and I don't see any reason to doubt that we could see some good news there, they use those prudence cushions, feeding them through to the bottom line when they're not needed. I do think it's possible to get there. Why didn't they do it sooner? Well, because the population's kind of impatient for, they want their treat now. They don't want to wait and have a bigger treat later. So that's kind of the mood of the times and part of the challenge that everybody faces. And I'd like to see a bit more leadership on the government's part, the Ontario government's part, certainly the federal government's part on this front, is to persuade people that maybe running a prudent fiscal policy, balancing the budget, paying your way as you go, that's a virtue, but that's an argument for another day.
But are there line items that expressly show you how the budget is going to be balanced by 2026, particularly in light of the projection on GDP for 2024 being 0.3%? We often grow our way out of deficit situations. Do you really think the economy is going to do the heavy lifting by the time we go back to the ballot box?
Well, it's such a conservative forecast that I think the upside potential is pretty good. Again, I go to the fact that there's this reserve below the line, but it's a reasonable sized one. It's all like, you know,
it's $5 billion.
And that's what it was before. And that's arguably getting a bit big there. This is a lesser of various evils thing. Those with long memories and memories that go back far enough to remember when hitting a bottom line target was a really big deal. And we didn't have this attitude that is so prevalent now of just saying, well, what's another deficit? Everybody's boring, so what the heck? But back in the days of Paul Martin's budgets, when he was retrenching, there was actually a lot of controversy over the lowballing of the revenue forecast. If you're deliberately misleading people, then I think that's a greater evil. I think it's much better. Maybe they're a little conservative on the economic side, but after all, a lot of us thought there was going to be a recession not that long ago, so you wouldn't like to see anything very aggressive there. But the other thing they do is they've got their $1.5 billion of potential spending to deal with. Let's hope it's, you know, it's it, the thing that's good about this kind of a system, it is relatively transparent. So if there are forest fires, if there are floods, if there's some other kind of thing that comes along, COVID, God forbid, then we've got that spending there that's quite clearly earmarked for that type of thing. And there's the reserve on the bottom line. It adds up to $2.5 billion in a budget of $200 billion. I think we can live with that.
You railed against the lack of transparency in municipal, provincial, and federal budgets for your entire tenure at the Institute. We've discussed that it's one thing to fund and launch a public policy program, but it's another thing to put benchmarks in the short, medium, and long term to ensure the planned spending has accomplished its goals. You're complimentary about the transparency in this one. What about the accountability? Has Ontario made any advances in this area of budgeting?
It's always a game of inches, and in games of inches, you can slip backwards as well as move forward. On the whole, though, I think Ontario deserves some credit. It wasn't that many years ago that the Ontario government wasn't getting clean audits from the Auditor General. The previous Auditor General had problems with a couple of things they were doing with pensions and with recording some revenue from electricity that was going to be sold years in the future. So they cleaned that up. And Ontario right now, I would say, is pretty much of a poster child for a province, happily not unique. Several provinces set a pretty high mark in this regard for showing you each budget, how it compares with the previous year, the projections, and what it anticipates for what they're going to be reporting at the end of the year. That doesn't sound like a big deal. The CDO Institute, we're a charity. We do that. Businesses do that. Certainly listed companies do, but sometimes governments don't. And I think that the Ontario government does deserve credit for that. The other thing that was related to the problems that they had with fiscal accountability is that they do now have the Auditor General looking at a few things in the budget. Now, again, what you really need is you need a vigilant population. You need vigilant MPPs to really check this stuff over. But there are a number of things that they've committed to do, including the budget timing, publishing or presenting their budget before the beginning of the fiscal year. When it comes to the fiscal plan and having a surplus in the fiscal plan. So at the end of when the Auditor General does her report at the end of this year, we will see her checklist of the things that the Ontario government has done. Is it as comprehensive as it could be? No. Does it guarantee that the money, in addition to being accounted for properly, was spent wisely? No, it doesn't guarantee that. That's really up to the voters to figure out. But there are a number of measures there that I think set a pretty high standard in this regard, and I'd love to see the federal government at the same level.
We sort of touched on York University getting a medical school, but what do you make of the 2.9% increase in overall healthcare spending?
That's going to be a tough one to hold the line on. However, it comes in the wake of a very large increase in healthcare spending the previous year. So if you kind of average the years together, what you're getting is a track that is not unrealistic. The difficult thing, though, is that healthcare spending is the juggernaut. In real per-person terms, the major categories of spending in Ontario are down over time, but not healthcare. Healthcare is not up by very much in real per person terms, but it's such a big part of the budget that when you've got that kind of increase, it pretty quickly squeezes everything else. And if you're paying for it with borrowed money, then you're in trouble because, of course, borrowed money comes with interest charges down the road. So I do worry about that. I also worry about what's happening on the long-term care side because it's not clear to me, and I'm happy to be proven wrong on this. I'm raising a suspicion rather than making an assertion, but there's a pretty strong proclivity right now in the wake of COVID and the horrors that unfolded in the long-term care sector to put a whole lot more money into the system as it is. And none of us wants to end our lives in that system. We don't want to spend the last few years of our lives in one of these facilities. We don't want to spend the last few weeks of our lives in an intensive care unit. But the way our healthcare system is set up right now, that's the path that a lot of us are on. So one of the things that I am looking for, and I wasn't confident I was seeing in this budget, is a commitment to start reinforcing the community-based care, the home-based care. That's what more people want. It's arguably less expensive, so you might end up with a happy situation there where the more cost-efficient course of action is actually the one that provides better care, rather than putting more money to a system that kind of let us down and that not many of us are looking forward to entering at any point in our lives. And people who have parents and other older relatives in the system right now, they welcome the extra money. But if you think about, you know, sort of moving one more step down that path as opposed to making other paths available, it's not obviously the best way to go.
If you had to give this budget a letter grade, what would it be and why?
I would give a fairly high letter grade for the transparency parts that I mentioned already. And I know that this isn't the stuff that makes everybody's heart beat faster. But I will just mention for the people who live in Ontario who are in the Toronto area, which is a fairly high proportion of the population, the budget debate that we had in Toronto was ridiculous because none of the numbers that people were talking about were the same numbers that are going to get reported at the end of the year. And I guarantee, and this amazes people, Toronto has always run surpluses, often very large surpluses, you know, sort of $2 billion on $13, $14 billion spending. They're going to do it again. And people will be amazed. And then the next budget debate will start and they'll forget. And we'll get into this frenzy of we're going to have to cut these services and we're going to have another big increase in property taxes. The same kind of conversation doesn't happen in Ontario because right away you're starting at a much higher level because you can look at the numbers and you can see, you mentioned the healthcare spending just now, it's all laying out in a way that's consistent with the past and consistent with how they'll report in the future. On all that, I would give them a high mark. When it comes to the fiscal sustainability part, I don't like seeing the higher deficit and I don't like seeing the continued moves to kind of shield people. It sounds good, shielding people from cost increases. But the trouble is that by foregoing the gas taxes, by foregoing the fuel taxes, by writing off the possibility that some of this infrastructure is going to pay its own way, by continuing to subsidize electricity, what they're really telling us is, we're just going to continue to, and maybe, I guess we didn't talk about some of the industrial stuff, but there's a lot of money being given to businesses. Is that really the way you want to run a provincial government in a sustainable way? I don't think so. I think that in the long run, they got to be thinking more about keeping their interest costs down, making sure that we've got competitive taxation in Ontario, which we don't currently right now for talented people. You're paying over 50% marginal tax rates. That's too high. And making sure that if we've made these costly decisions in the electricity sector, and they weren't all smart decisions, but those costs are there now. And the right way to deal with it is to divert money, especially borrowed money, into an electricity subsidy. Just before we wrap up, if it's okay by you, I do want to just make a couple of shout outs for things that didn't get a lot of attention in the budget, but I thought were very good. One of the things they did, I talked about making infrastructure pay its own way. There's a measure in the budget looking at electricity utilities and facilitating consolidation that would otherwise face a tax penalty. Again, not something that makes everybody's heart beat faster, but there's a lot of concern right now that Canadian pension funds, including the big ones based in Ontario, are investing a lot of their money outside Canada. And one of the reasons they do that is because the types of assets they want to own, such as airports and ports and toll roads and toll bridges and water and electricity utilities, are not very available here in Canada. And I just love to see measures that are taken that are going to encourage consolidation of utilities that are very small, often not that well run by municipalities, and create an asset that can be run more professionally and that would be attractive on that front. And since I mentioned pensions, I'll squeeze in another one. For people who care about these things, the establishment of a target benefit framework is a great idea. We have been struggling for a long time with defined benefit pension plans really being very risky, very hard to be sustainable. But the alternative, if all the alternatives are defined contribution or RRSPs, there's really something missing. And this target benefit framework is a nice way of trying to get a bit of the best of both worlds. So among all the details that were in the budget, a lot of which were kind of rehashed, there were a few things there that I was very happy to see, and I wanted to give them shout outs on that front. So overall, Probably not an A-grade budget, but certainly a solid B-range budget. If only they would pay a bit more attention to the bottom line and get us that budget balance faster so that we weren't worried about interest payments growing and crowding everything else out, including healthcare spending, then I'd be up in the A range.
Bill, thank you so much for your time and insight today.
Thank you.
Bill Robson is the CEO of the C.D. Howe Institute. For further insight into Ontario Budget 2024, visit cdhowe.org. I'm Michael Ainsworth. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the C.D. Howe Institute podcast with Michael Ainsworth. Subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. The C.D. Howe Institute is an independent, not-for-profit research institute whose mission is to raise living standards by fostering economically sound public policies. The Institute is widely considered to be Canada's most influential think tank and a trusted source of essential policy intelligence, distinguished by nonpartisan, evidence-based research and subject to definitive expert review. Visit cdhowe.org and follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Thank you.